Case number 20-5850, Tara Blessing et al. Versus Sujana Chandrasekhar. And 20-5852, John Doe versus Kathy Griffin. Oral argument is not to exceed 15 minutes for the plaintiffs and 15 minutes to be shared by the defendants. Mr. Seifried for the appellants.
Afternoon. If it pleases the court and counsel, Kent Seifried for the appellants. I'd like to reserve 3 minutes of my time. In this consolidated argument, I will make 2 points. First, the district court had personal jurisdiction over both appellees. Alternatively, and as necessary, appellee Griffin waived her personal jurisdiction defense. In 1968, when the Kentucky General Assembly enacted Kentucky's long-arm statute, under established Kentucky constitutional, statutory, and common law, a non-resident's criminal communication directed to a Kentucky resident was an act that occurred in the Commonwealth. Specifically, under the common law territoriality principle, a non-resident, when he or she directed a criminal communication to a Kentucky resident, the actus reus of that crime occurred in Kentucky where the communication was received. And because the actus reus occurred in Kentucky, constitutionally, a non-resident could be prosecuted because that's where the crime shall have been committed.
I thought the, Mr. Seifried, I thought the actus reus was the action that the party takes rather than the consequences of the action.
Exactly, Your Honor. And when we look as far back as that, is the Commonwealth versus Hatfield, Kentucky case in 1889, I believe, the point being made under the common law is that the act traveled with the action, not just the consequences of the act, but the act itself arrived in the location where it was received.
Well, I mean, I guess to kind of cut to the chase on the concern I have with the argument you're making now, that conception of actus reus does not seem consistent with subsection A4 of the Kentucky long arm statute, which, as you probably know, it says a claim arising from a person's causing tortious injury in this commonwealth by an act or omission outside the commonwealth. And then it describes the circumstances where that can give rise to jurisdiction. So it's making a clear distinction between the injury in the commonwealth and an action outside. Why doesn't that defeat your argument?
Because the particular acts that are addressed in subsection 4 are not tortious criminal communications, which at the time the long-arm statute was enacted were already understood and intended to be acts in the Commonwealth for purposes of subsection A3. And that is what's important about not only the common law and constitutional and statutory understanding of criminal communications as acts in the Commonwealth, but also the interface with Kentucky 446070, which rendered those criminal acts in the Commonwealth tortiously actionable. Both those principles were in place, long in place, in 1968 when the legislature adopted the long-arm statute and used the word act. And when they did, they presumptively knew the law and they unambiguously intended the word act, that term in the subsection A3, to include tortious criminal.
Well, then, I mean, you're telling us that act means one thing in A3 and something quite different in A4.
No, I'm saying that in A3, the understanding of what an act was in terms of a criminal communication into the Commonwealth, that was already understood in the law as being an act. And when we look
under A3, act means one thing with respect to criminal communications, and it means something totally different with regard to other actions.
And here's why. When we look at KRS 446.
It's an odd, very odd way to read a statute.
Well, only when we, I don't think so, and here's why. Because what we understand and are instructed by KRS 446.080, subparagraph 4, is that when terms in the law already have a particular legal meaning, they are to be so construed for the purposes of other portions of that statute or others. That's the general way that statutes are to be interpreted in Kentucky. And in 1968, that term act had that particular legal meaning for those kind of tortious criminal communicative conduct. And so one way of looking at it is the legislator didn't have to specifically carve out or make another subsection to add something that already existed in the law.
I have a question to you. What's your best Kentucky case or federal case in Kentucky to back up your proposal here?
I would take first, Your Honor, we've talked about the State Farm versus Reeder case from the Kentucky Supreme Court in 1988, which stands for the proposition that the existence of 446.070 is presumed by the legislature, and that when the legislature passes subsequent legislation, it understands what 446.070 will do. And 446.070 had already rendered criminal communications as tortious acts in the Commonwealth. Then we combine that not only with a case, but we bring into there the construction statutes, again, 446.080, and the subsections of that, which point out that the legislature not only understands and intends existing law to be part of what it puts into its legislation, but the courts are then to interpret the and construe the statute to achieve its objective. And there's a number of Kentucky Supreme Court cases that make that general point, but here specifically, the purpose of a long-arm statute is to extend personal jurisdiction where constitutionally allowable under due process to those acts that harm Kentucky citizens. And that's what the legislature was doing by extending it to non-resident criminal communication tortious acts.
So it's pretty safe to say that the Kentucky legislators and officials you're talking about weren't thinking about a tweet in a state far away from Kentucky, were they?
No, ma'am, and they weren't thinking because tweets is just the means of communication. But here's what they were thinking about. They were thinking about letters, and they were thinking about telephone calls. Because in 1942, the legislature passed a statute which criminalized threatening letters. And in 1966, just 2 years before the long-arm statute, they also criminalized obscene telephone calls. These are simply non-resident means of communication that can harm both criminally and civilly, a Kentucky resident. The means of a tweet is just a different type of form of communication, but the idea that communication is an act in the Commonwealth for which the long arm statute extends reach under A3 was in the law and understood and intended by the legislature to capture that kind of act. And Your Honor, and to go back to what Judge Seiler said about federal law, we pointed out in our brief that the true threat statutes in Kentucky are the type of acts that are captured by the long-arm statute. And what's important here is that the true threat analysis of a true threat is where the speaker intends to cause his or her recipient to have fear of violence and the disruption that that fear causes. That also occurs when and where received. And that's what the various federal cases, whether that's this Sixth Circuit case in United States versus, if I pronounce this correctly, Al-Kabaz, the 1998 case, as well as the Wheeler case in out of the 10th Circuit. So again, that's where the communication is received, that's where the act occurs. That's consistent with what a true threat is, because a true threat is reasonably does the speaker's intended audience, a group or an individual? Do they reasonably perceive the comment and the communication as a threat? If they do, that occurs where it's received. Again, consistent with the view of an act under A3 in the Kentucky's long arm statute as these type of criminal communications. And in this particular instance, both appellees' tweets, just Judge Gibbons getting back to just the form of their communication, these are true threats. In other words, you know, when Ms. Griffin, appellee Griffin, called on her followers to dox the students, to identify them, to locate them, she was engaging, calling on people in the Commonwealth who knew them, as she put it, vouch for them and vouch who they are and where they are, where they live, who they are, identifying. She also engaged their school. She said, reach out to their school and tell them how you feel about these children. And we know that was her content of her tweet, and we know her intent, because not only is calling for somebody to be doxxed, that is, reveal private information, the very purpose of that is to harass, but more importantly, take a look at her reaction. She got followers who she reveled in the fact that, as she put it, oh, you triggered lots of very threatened bros. Same thing with Dr., and I apologize for the pronunciation, Sandra Secor. Her content of her tweet, she posted their pictures, but not just from the public event on the Lincoln Memorial. No, no, no. These were formatted into a wanted poster style with the accompanying text all capped that told where they were, Covington Catholic, and said to the community, do you know them? The world would like to know. And not only did she engage the community in Kentucky to identify these children, but she said these children and their parents and the whole community should be re-educated massively. She's not only focusing on the children, she's focusing on the community. And again,
are you running into First Amendment issues by preventing people from making such criticisms over the air?
A true threat is not protected by the First Amendment because its very content is a crime, and the comment itself is integral to the crime. So hence, it's not protected by the First Amendment, a long line of authorities from the Virginia versus Black, both before and after. And the similarly in the Jeffries case out of the Sixth Circuit make that point. And I just would finish on the due process argument, which is when we look at Walden, the Supreme Court in Walden made clear that the nature of true threats mean that the appellees in this case both focus not only on the appellants themselves, but on the community of Kentucky, on the forum. In other words,
your time's up, and we have understood your point about that case.
I appreciate that. Thank you, Your Honor, and I will reserve my 3 minutes. Thank you.
All right, Mr. Palmer, I believe you're to argue first. Is that correct?
Yes, Judge, that's correct.
You may proceed.
May it please the court, my name is Jason Palmer, and I represent Dr. Sujana Chandrasekhar, and I will be addressing the personal jurisdiction issues common to the appellees here. After my time, Mr. Greigel, counsel for Ms. Griffin, will address the waiver issue and any issues unique to her case. You know, to kind of echo Judge Kethledge here and to cut to the chase, nobody is being prosecuted here. This is not a criminal case. There's an allegation that the conduct would also violate criminal statutes. I don't think the facts alleged support that, but that issue is not before the court. The question here is whether the district court had personal jurisdiction under the Kentucky long-arm statute, which the Kentucky Supreme Court has said sets forth 9 particular instances of conduct that support jurisdiction. And one of those instances, the only one at issue here, is subpart 2A3, which requires an act or omission in this Commonwealth. And the Kentucky Supreme Court in Caesars Riverboat said that actions that take place outside of Kentucky are not within this Commonwealth. The Kentucky Court of Appeals in Garifin said that a communication, a letter in that case, which my friend on the other side said is no different from a tweet, is not an act or omission in the Commonwealth of Kentucky if it's sent from out of state, even if the recipient and subject is a resident of Kentucky. Now, the negligence per se statute that—
Mr. Palmer, are you talking about the Pierce case right now?
Yes.
All right, thanks.
Pierce versus Serafin.
Very good.
So the negligence per se statute doesn't use the word criminal anywhere. It does not allow someone to bring a cause of action based on common law crimes. It allows a cause of action based on a violation of a statute. And that's reflected in the State Farm case. And the statutes at issue here would not have been violated by the facts alleged, but again, that issue is not before the court. The balance struck here between subpart 2A3 and 2A4, I think, is an incredibly broad interpretation of personal jurisdiction. It amounts to the contention that a plaintiff who just alleges the violation of a criminal statute, regardless of whether the facts alleged would actually violate that criminal statute, can get around the requirements of those 9 particular instances of jurisdiction under the long-arm statute. And I don't, there's no support in the law for that. It would be a substantial innovation in Kentucky law, and there are no authoritative signals from the legislature or judiciary, and general principles about common law are not enough to support such an innovation. And that's, you know, from State Auto Property and Casualty Insurance Company versus Hargis. The specific pronouncements from the courts and legislature are clear. There are 9 specific instances of jurisdiction of the long-arm statute. The Kentucky Supreme Court has said that those are exclusive. They do not reach the full length of the Due Process Clause. And the Court of Appeals spoke in Pierce versus Serafin that an out-of-state communication is not an act or omission in the Commonwealth. Therefore, the district court properly concluded that it lacked jurisdiction under the long-arm statute and should be affirmed on that point. As to due process clause, I would point out that the criminal-civil distinction is even less relevant here because it's a matter of federal constitutional law, not Kentucky state law. You know, under Walden versus Fiore, a plaintiff's contacts with the forum state cannot be decisive in determining whether the defendant's due process rights are violated. The relationship must arise out of context the defendant himself creates with the forum state, not with the plaintiff. And the plaintiff's contacts with the forum state are not enough. The defendant has to reach out to the forum state and avail themselves of the laws there. Here, there's no allegation that the tweets are accounts that are particularly geared toward a Kentucky audience, that nobody from Kentucky was tagged or attached to the tweets. They were not in replies to anybody from Kentucky. There's not even an allegation in the complaint that either of the appellees has any followers in Kentucky. As to Dr. Chandrasekhar, appellants allege that her tweet was retweeted and communicated throughout the Commonwealth of Kentucky. But if somebody retweets and communicates her tweet, that is not her action linking her tweet to the forum. In reply, appellants rely on Doe's versus Holland, but Doe's versus Holland is not a personal jurisdiction case. The court makes very clear it is not offering an opinion on whether it has personal jurisdiction over the defendants there. But the court does cite the 10th Circuit analysis from Schrader versus Biddinger in a footnote. And in Schrader, the 10th Circuit indicated that internet posts are peculiarly non-territorial communications. And I think that's what happened here. We have non-territorial tweets that did not target the Kentucky forum or provide even close to the level of contact that would be necessary to give rise to jurisdiction there. The other cases cited by appellants involve numerous intentional communications deliberately into Kentucky. Sneal versus Jansen and Power Investments LLC versus SLEC LLC. There are no deliberate communications with Kentucky. There's no business done with Kentucky. None of the facts that gave jurisdiction in those cases are present here. And, you know, Walden actually does provide a good example of the kind of digital contact that might give rise to jurisdiction. Walden offers the example of fraudulent access to financial accounts. Again, that's a deliberate contact that targets a resident of a forum and property in that forum. There's nothing of the kind here. The appellees posted tweets from their home states. The conduct at issue occurred in Washington, D.C. It was entirely fortuitous that the appellants are Kentucky residents, and nothing in the tweets or otherwise would support jurisdiction here, and the district court should be affirmed. If there's no other questions, I will yield my time.
Mr. Greigel, is that the correct pronunciation?
Yes, it is, Greigel. Thank you, Judge Gibbons. Good afternoon, may it please the court. Mike Greigel from Greenberg Traurig, representing the appellee Kathy Griffin. We certainly share in the jurisdictional points made by Mr. Palmer, but I'm going to focus my remarks on the waiver issue that has been briefed extensively by the parties to the court. And I would submit that this all turns on the principle of law that's established by this court's 2011 decision in Gerber v. Reardon. And that case set forth a two-part test to determine when and whether a party's legal submissions to a court constituted a submission to the jurisdiction of the court. And there's two parts to the test. Did the submission give the plaintiff a reasonable expectation that a defendant is going to defend the case on the merits? Or in the disjunctive, did the defendant do anything to cause the court to go to effort that would later prove to be wasted if jurisdiction was found to be lacking? And that was the test that was established in Gerber v. Reardon by this court. It was clarified a year later in 2012 in King v. Taylor, where the court explained at 694 F3rd at page 659, we recently clarified the test for finding forfeiture of a personal jurisdiction defense through conduct. And the court made it plain that in determining whether there was a forfeiture, there should be a contextual determination dependent on judicial examination of all the relevant circumstances. Even more recently, in November of 2019, Judge Seiler cited Gerber for this two-part test in Matthews v. Charles Kurtz & Company, reported at 791 Fed APPX at 562. While it is true that Gerber ultimately held that the voluntary acceptance of jurisdiction in that case was based on the filing of a notice of appearance, that conclusion was only reached after a consideration of the party's litigation activity in the case as a whole. And that, we have submitted in our briefing to the court, has been the overwhelming interpretation of district courts in this circuit in relying on and applying the Gerber case. We submit to the court that it's the only interpretation of Gerber that makes sense, because otherwise, why would the court have indulged in this painstaking recitation of the litigation history between the parties, commenting that certain submissions qualified as a voluntary forfeiture of jurisdiction and others did not? The fundamental point I want to make to this panel this afternoon is that the reading of Gerber being urged by the plaintiffs in their briefing is fundamentally incompatible with the requirements of Rule 12 of the federal rules. Gerber itself acknowledged that the requirement of personal jurisdiction flows from an individual liberty interest protected by the Due Process Clause. In order to waive such a right, It has to be knowing and voluntary. There are two and only two ways to effectuate a waiver under the federal rules. Number one, failure to make it by a motion under 12b2. That's what Ms. Griffin did here. She didn't waive anything. Or failure to include a personal jurist defense in a subsequent responsive pleading. Surely no one can contest that the filing of a one-page ministerial notice of appearance is a responsive pleading. Judge Bertelsmann got it exactly right below. He held in denying the plaintiff's motion for reconsideration that a defendant thus need not enter a special appearance to assert a lack of personal jurisdiction. She must only comply with Rule 12. That is exactly what Ms. Griffin did. The plaintiffs are trying unabashedly to resurrect this technical distinction between a general and a special appearance that went out with the adoption of the federal rules in 1938. The requirement of a special appearance, again, now cast aside by the federal rules, has been expressly disavowed by this case, this court, dating back to 2002 in County Security Agency v. Ohio Department of Commerce at 296 F3rd 483, where this court stated unequivocally, in order to object to the exercise of personal jurisdiction, it is no longer necessary to enter a special appearance. That has been the rule prevailing in this court for close to two decades now. There's no reason to depart from that here. We are left with the court's decision coming after King v. Taylor, which is in the MNC Corp v. Edward Bear. And I will concede that that decision is hardly a model of clarity. And it does interpret Gerber as a effectuating a waiver by the filing of the ministerial act of a notice of appearance. However, 2 points. Number one, that is an unreported decision. It's not binding authority. Two, it has universally not been followed by the circuit courts in this district. And three, it's impossible to reconcile that holding with the express requirements of Rule 12. The bottom line, Your Honors, is I do think Judge Bertelsmann below said that he didn't buy a distinction between forfeiture and waiver. I actually think there is a distinction, although I think he was correct in descriptively pointing out that the terms have been used interchangeably by courts in this circuit, including this court. Waiver is where you initially relinquish a right by not complying with Rule 12. And again, there's only two ways to do it. Forfeiture is where you initially correctly reserve the right by complying with Rule 12, and then through your litigation conduct, ultimately give it up. At the end of the day, Gerber, as clarified by this court in King v. Taylor, is a forfeiture case. And that is confirmed by the facts of Gerber itself, where a careful reading indicates that the very first step of the defendants, and there were two in Gerber, was to file a Rule 12b2 motion to dismiss for lack of personal jurisdiction. One motion was filed on behalf of the personal defendant, the individual. The other was filed on behalf of the co-defendant, the corporate entity. Both were proceeding pro se. And the court found that the 12b2 personal jurisdiction motion on behalf of the corporate entity was technically incorrect because a corporate entity needs legal representation and could not proceed pro se. It was only then that the court ordered the notice of appearance. So as in point of fact, Gerber is not a first filing notice of appearance case as described by the plaintiffs in their briefing. And that fact, I'm sorry.
Your time's up.
Okay, thank you very much.
Okay.
Thank you.
Mr. Seifried, I think you have 3 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. On the waiver argument, let me just make these points that we believe that Gerber is a bright line per se rule for these reasons. First, the language of the case, that is clearly its holding. Secondly, as mentioned, the MC Corp decision of this circuit actually followed and applied Gerber, saying it was, in its words, directly on point. Third, there's the conduct of other defendants in this circuit. You don't have to ever file a general appearance, any kind of appearance. But if you choose to do so, after Gerber, you make it a special appearance, as defendants have done so in the Means case and the Parchment case. Fourth, judicial administration. Precedent really does matter. It does give clarity and certainty to the law, as do bright line rules, which this is. And finally, each of the appellee's arguments that Gerber is in fact not what it says it is, were arguments advanced by Judge Moore and her concurrences in both Gerber and MC Corp. And those particular arguments, even some of the same authorities, were simply not accepted by the two panels, including Judge Moore's lament that a single, as counsel just said, a single one-line entry, a ministerial act, could not mean what the panel said it meant. So for those reasons, yes, Gerber applies, and yes, the appellee Griffin waives
her jurisdiction. Mr. Siegfried, if I can just engage you again in the Kentucky long arm statute.
Oh, sure.
I mean, I guess I'm struggling to see why, as a federal court sitting in diversity, we aren't bound by the holding of the Kentucky Court of Appeals in Pierce v. Serafin, the 1990 case. Mr. Palmer mentioned it. I mean, this was a case that involved a letter that the defendant sent, which, you know, I think it's common ground here that there are similarities between letters and tweets for our purposes. And in that case, the Kentucky Court of Appeals said, Kentucky has elected to assume personal jurisdiction over a non-resident tortfeasor whose activities outside the state result in injury in this state only if that tortfeasor regularly does or solicits business within the state or has other substantial connection to the Commonwealth. Do you dispute that that holding is applicable here?
Yes, it is not applicable for a couple of reasons. First of all, that letter did not even go to the plaintiff. It had nothing. There was no direct communication to the plaintiff.
Well, that's true.
It was a letter from one doctor.
That's true here as well. So,
that's the distinction, Your Honor. We talk about the letter from one doctor to another doctor in Pierce, for which there was only an effect on the plaintiffs, i.e., that their medical private information was revealed. But the difference is, in this case, we're not talking about the tort of invasion of privacy. We're talking about true threat torts, which are based on criminal laws, which by constitution are acts that occur in the Commonwealth. And those
two, I understand that argument,
view so. From the recipient's point of view, not the
community. All right. Okay. I understand your argument, and your time's up. So that answers my question.
Thank you.
I understand. It just ties back into the argument you made before. So I do understand that. Thank you.
Thank you.
We appreciate the arguments all of you have given, and we'll consider the case carefully.